Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Big Unlock podcast. My name is Ritu M. Oberoi, and I'll be your host today along with Rohit Mahajan. And we are really excited and very pleased to have Sally Ann Frank with us today. She leads the worldwide health life sciences strategy programs and portfolio for Microsoft for Startups. And she has a front row seat to how AI is, you know, reshaping industries and particularly startups. She brings a unique perspective on what separates these breakout startups from the rest. And we're really excited to ask her about the Unicorn Protocol as well. So in this conversation, we will explore how startups can move from experimentation to real enterprise impact in an increasingly AI-first world. And with that, I'll pass it to Rohit for a really short introduction, and then all yours, Sally. Welcome once again to the Big Unlock podcast.
Thank you, Ritu. I'm Rohit. I'm the co-host of the Big Unlock podcast. And we did do more than 200 episodes at this point in time. And we are very fortunate to have met you, Sally, at HIMSS and, you know, learn about the Unicorn Protocol. We were together at the author's launch at Taylor Francis booth. So very, very fortunate meeting and glad to have you on this podcast with us as well. So over to you for your introductions.
Thank you. Thank you so much, both of you, for inviting me to join you today. So as Ritu said, I am the startup lead for health and life sciences globally at Microsoft for Startups. And our organization is really just dedicated to helping startups grow and scale using our technology and leveraging our customer network. So I've been in role for a little bit more than 5 years, been at Microsoft for more than 10 years. I have been working in healthcare for about 10 years as well. And prior to this, I worked with a Microsoft partner that was a very small company, almost like a startup when I joined. So I was there for 16 years. So I've been on that journey about being a small company in the large Microsoft ecosystem. I've also had two businesses of my own. And as you alluded to, I have the Unicorn Protocol and the book before that, which is the Startup Protocol, which are all designed really to help educate startups in digital health and life sciences, really maximize their investments of time, effort, and energy to become more successful.
Thank you, Sally. We have so much to learn from you. I guess we'll start with the first question. So we know that Microsoft for Startups offers, you know, infrastructure, credits, and ecosystem access. But in your opinion, what have you seen that really separates startups that convert that support into, you know, enterprise traction from those that stall? Like if everyone's starting out with the same level playing field, then what happens after that? We would love to know that.
I think it comes down to a few key areas. One is understanding your stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So as part of the Microsoft ecosystem, there are three stakeholders. There are the partners themselves and what they need to do to be successful. There are the end customers that we jointly have. And then there are the other people that we work with, account teams, product teams, Microsoft Research, you know, all of these other organizations that can also be part of that growth strategy that the startup has. So understanding those different audiences and being able to message, just as you would with different end customers, the different stakeholders that we have in Microsoft is really helpful. I think one of the other things that separates those that succeed with those that don't quite achieve that success is making sure that innovation doesn't stop with the technology. You know, we're all about AI and what can it do to further workflows and research and all of that. But actually, the ones that are most successful also innovate business models. They innovate when the hiring practices or compensation approach or how they go to market, what their business models are. And I think that comes out really clearly in the Unicorn Protocol, because if you read through those 10 case studies, you'll see that the innovation didn't stop right at, well, we're going to do innovative tech. So I think that's another facet. And then I think the final facet is being coachable. The fact of the matter is that none of us can truly innovate on our own. And so if you are driven to be successful, having strategic mentorship, working with your investor if you have one, working with your hyperscaler, and listening to the customers that you have and doing that strong customer discovery throughout the journey enables you to be coachable and to take in all of these different pieces of information so that you building a foundation that is successful today and can morph as AI morphs because we're moving so quickly.
I think that's a great answer. And, you know, you provided really good insights that everybody should listen to and understand, because like you said, you know, everybody thinks it stops with the product, but what you're saying is you have to go beyond that and keep innovating even after you have the product. Yeah. So that leads to the next question, Sally, like from your vantage point, you know, what do you think is the single biggest barrier startups face when they start selling into these large enterprises? Because, you know, initially they have these one or two showcase clients, everything looks good. But then when it really comes to the rubber hitting the road and they get into the enterprise sales, that's when we see that some people get left behind. So would love to hear your thoughts about that.
You know, it's interesting. Recently, I had a startup founder come to me and say, the sales cycles are so long. It's 12, 18 months. Wow. And yes, that does happen. But one of the things that I think is clear when a startup is working with an enterprise and it keeps getting extended and extended and extended, and we'll get back to you, we'll get back to you, we'll get back to you, is that there is not a strong value proposition that instills a sense of urgency around getting the startup's solution in-house. Mm-hmm. So if it's not compelling from the get-go, and they can see themselves living without your solution for a long time, that's a problem. So making sure that it's compelling enough that they want to act sooner. The other thing I think about is oftentimes, and I see this a lot, where a startup will follow up with a prospective enterprise customer, even from the first pitch, or to the other areas where they are focused, whether it's the first pitch or they've already identified an opportunity and they're working that, you need to add value every single time. So when you're doing the first pitch, you don't end with, so what do you think? You end with, was that helpful for you? I'd love some feedback to find out what we could do that would make this more compelling for you. I'd like to add some features if that's appropriate. So that's one area. The other area is you follow up with an email and say, so we met last week. What do you think? What's our next step? Like, you need to be prescriptive and say, typically, this may not fit for you, but typically after we do this demo, we do a strategy session so that we can refine and customize our solution directly for the problem that you're trying to solve and the unique characteristics that your organization has. So it's all about the bottom line. Add value at every interaction, whether it's an email, I saw this article about a competitor of yours, I think this is something we can help you with. Or we've just released a new feature, a new function, which directly reflects one of the things that we talked about. So every interaction, so that you become not a vendor, but you become a trusted advisor. And that's what you're going for.
That's the key distinguishing factor, I guess you're trying to.
Absolutely.
Sally, this is fantastic practical advice because you've been in the shoes of the entrepreneur. So you know the pain having been there. So please tell us a bit about your journey in the healthcare industry segment. Like, you are heading Microsoft's initiatives in the startup in healthcare and life sciences. So why not automotive or any other industry segment? And how did you like to be here? I would love to hear that story as well.
Yeah, well, thank you, Rohit. So one of the interesting things is I have been a lifelong business developer and technologist. I've been in a variety of different aspects of our field for many decades, more than I will admit to. But about 10 years ago, I had the opportunity at Microsoft to join our IoT team as a specialist in that field, specifically for healthcare. And when the opportunity was presented, they asked me, so what do you know about healthcare? And I said, well, I've been a patient before. And I'd been doing a lot of IoT in manufacturing. And so what I found was the discrete manufacturing IoT scenarios worked really well with the process manufacturing for pharmaceuticals and the discrete manufacturing for medical devices, as well as doing things like remote patient monitoring, cold chain tracking. There were lots of things that, while I didn't have direct experience, I could apply my IoT experience and my own experience to the field. However, I've not been a clinician. I've never been a scientist. And so to fill that gap, starting from day one when I took that role, I have spent at least anywhere from a half hour to an hour each day reading bespoke news feeds that I get. Thank you, AI. So that I can understand the industry better. And then just my personal thing, I like to read. So I read a book for fun and then a book for work, a book for fun and then a book for work, so that I'm constantly being updated and filling that. Frankly, it was a lot about filling the gap about what I didn't know about the industry. But now it's filling some gaps and continuing the learning. And that is what I'm so passionate about. That role 10 years ago or whatever it was, really uncovered a deep passion for the industry that I didn't know I had, because I've been doing IoT and manufacturing, which was cool. But then you apply it to healthcare and the impact that you can have on patients and their outcomes and their health. It's like, oh, wait, this is a whole new level of impact that I'm very, very excited about. And so I really treasure and cherish this role that I'm in and the ability to work directly with people that are improving outcomes for our patients.
I think Sally chose an amazing time to come into this industry, because the level of change that has happened recently is like, you know,
Totally.
You know, Elena Seni said at the keynote, opening keynote, may we live in interesting times. So I think this is definitely one of those times. And it's great that you, you know, got a chance to really contribute to this field and be here when this whole generative AI wave hit. So coming to, you know, this AI now thing where you said, you know, you have to read these newsletters every single day just to try to keep up with what's happening, because every day there's some news and something new coming in. So then in your opinion, you must be seeing so many startups. So what are founders still misunderstanding about building, you know, sustainable, defensible businesses in this space? Like everybody's just adding AI for, you know, the sake of it. But what do you think really distinguishes that unique startup that succeeds, which is doing, you know, AI right, from the rest of the field?
Yeah. So I do think, going back to what we talked about earlier, showing value. Okay. So one of the things that we think about is like 2024 was the year of experimentation. 2025 was the year of pilots. Mm-hmm. And although this isn't on the Gartner hype cycle, 2026 is the show me the money year. So it all has to be about return on investment. And look, if you're an early stage company, you may not have the ability to show return on investment from the get-go, but you should have a framework for what that's going to look like. And you should have an understanding as to what types of value propositions and statements you're going to have, the types of metrics you're going to track, and ideally what types of savings, labor savings, expediting of workflows, removal of steps, whatever it is, you should have an idea and a target so that you know what you're shooting for. And the customers that you're talking to in those early days about customer discovery, you can literally ask them, are these the things that are important to you? And are these the things that we should be starting to calculate ROI on? The other thing that often happens, and this goes a little bit to just the naivete of some of the founders, is that we see this pilot purgatory. I'm sure you've heard this phrase before. So you get the pilot, you're all excited. Yay, we're going to get a pilot with this big customer. And it goes well. You've documented the results. And then the customer comes back to you and goes, we love it. Now what? And you go, we've never done an employee, you know. So the point I'm making is that while you're doing the pilot, you have to plan for success and start planning the full production implementation. Because if you start with a pilot, it gets executed and it's great, and then there's not a next step, the law of diminishing interest sets in. So the longer it is between the pilot and when you start building in production, the less likely they are to move into production, because they will find a way to just, we didn't need it that much. The other thing is you cannot forget about the change management aspect of this. In most cases, you are asking people to do something that they're not doing. So the best way to do that is to say, instead of these 10 steps, we're going to ask you to do only these 5 steps. Or we're going to automate 5 of those steps. You only have to do 2 steps or whatever it is. But it's important that also gets conveyed in a way that, again, going back to the customer, they need to say, I can't live without that.
So basically, you're saying that, you know, make it valuable for the enterprise so that they...
And make it easy. And make it easy to buy. Make it easy to work with you. Be sensitive to the change management that they have to do. You cannot be their change management, their organizational development people. But be sensitive to that and at least support those efforts in a way that kind of opens the gate for you to deploy in full production.
Yeah. Have a plan to, like, I think my takeaway from what Sally mentioned is that have the end in mind that you need to go into production. Pilot is only a way to kind of get to that stage. So you kind of have a plan and plan with the customer buy-in that, look, this is how we are going to go into production, and do it fast because otherwise they'll lose interest.
Yeah, the final thing I'll say is, you know, invariably you're working with somebody at the enterprise that is kind of your champion or is your point of contact. Make that person look good. Like, let them take all the glory. You step back. Let them take all the glory. They will be much more inclined to do a video snippet with you or a case study with you if you make them look good. And look, we're all doing this because we feel passionate about it, but a little bit of professional and personal growth through the process or values from it, from working together, is also very good.
Yeah. So make the champion look good. And, you know, let them succeed as well. Great.
Ritu, I'll add one more thing. Sally, please tell us if you've seen this happen before also. So sometimes when we work with our clients, we become their technology partner and sign a co-development or a collaboration agreement at that point in time itself. So that means your interests are tied together. And they might even benefit from, you know, let's say, co-development license fees later on. So I just wanted to mention that for your advice and comments. Yeah.
Yes, it's a wonderful business model where everybody wins.
So before we jump into the next serious question, you said you love to read and you alternate, you know, reading for fun and reading for work. So tell us about the last two books you've read, one for fun and one for work.
I'm reading The Jazz Bird now, which is about, it's kind of mafiosa type of book. But I think a few of my favorite books, and actually they were all written by friends. So Empowering Nurses with Technology is a great book and it was so helpful for me because it helped me understand the nursing process and procedures that they have to go through and kind of their lives in a way that I couldn't. Then Tom Lowry has a book, AI in Healthcare and Healthcare Nation. Those are both really good books. And then Gil Bash published, was it Healing the Sick Care System? I think is what it, GILBASHE. But those are all really great books. And they come to it from a different perspective because we're looking at Kathleen's book from a nursing perspective, Tom's book from an AI ecosystem perspective and fixing our healthcare system. And then Gil comes at it from kind of the, like, he was a medic before, he's been in healthcare his whole life. So he comes at it from more of the patient voice, patient advocate perspective. And so they're really all great books that kind of give you a feel of the ecosystem today.
Thank you so much, Sally. Thank you for sharing that with our listeners. I'm definitely going to put those on my reading list. So,
great.
So with the number of startups and, you know, you have access to like a wide variety. So what do you see coming down, you know, in the next 6 months to a year, if you would like to make some predictions for where we will be or what's going to be the next one?
I'm not in the prediction game, but I will tell you what my aspirations are for our ecosystem. So one is improved access globally so that we can use virtual technology, cell phones, whatever we have, so that everyone is entitled to healthcare, whether it's doing a virtual visit or it's helping a surgeon in some remote area do surgery with a specialist in another country. So access is one area that I'm very passionate about. Another area that I hope we will do better in is women's health. So starting in like 1993, we were finally part of clinical trials on a regular basis. So that's a big problem. But half of our population are women, and we still get 2% of the investment in women's health. And the investment that is made is typically focused on reproductive health, menopause, and all of that. But there's a lot more to women. We present differently for cardiology, diabetes, you know, all kinds of stuff. So that's another area that I'm hoping we will improve upon. Then I'm also interested in personalized medicine and how do we use all the AI around genetics and zipnomes and medications to really treat each person as an individual as they go through either chronic conditions or acute situations. And then the final thing is flipping the switch from our break-fix model to preventative medicine, longevity medicine, and things that we can do to improve not just the lifespan, but the health span. This goes back to the women's health issue. Women typically live 6 to 8 years longer, but spend more time sick. So how do we fix that? And how do we really improve the quality of life for everyone until the day they die? So those aren't necessarily predictions, but that's kind of where I'm hoping the industry goes.
Great. I think, you know, you're so right with the last one, because like we had Dr. Klasko on for our 200th episode, and he really mentioned that, like he said, the annual physical, the word itself has like, it's so problematic because first of all, it's annual. Now you have the stream of, you know, health data coming in from the wearables. And secondly, it's physical. Like what about the mental and, you know, your whole body, your holistic? So I think that's great. Now we look for more preventative or longevity medicine like you talked about.
I was just thinking in my mind that these are four bridges to the future that you have painted, Sally, for everyone to think about. They're huge in itself. And it's very, very good food for thought for ourselves and for the listeners as well. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you, Rohit. And thank you, Ritu, for the time today.
It's been great.